Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithel Day. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great ATQ writers, Badwater. How you doing?
Oh, doing pretty good. Not bad for a Tuesday.
Not bad.
And I'm getting a chance to catch up on my manga and anime. So life is good.
Many happy returns. I was going to say something in Japanese, but it was rude. You've been covering the women's volleyball team for the site, and it must have been a pleasurable experience because the Oregon is on a real hot streak, and their last three matches they played at home. So we've sent you off to watch them. In fact, you've done some original reporting because I think a couple of those weren't really televised, right?
Right. Yeah, I found out at the last moment that the weekend's matches against the Oregon schools were on Oregon's live. They were on Oregon live stream, but I was there at the games.
Yeah. Fun team to watch, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. The this is a really good volleyball team, the likes of which I don't recall having seen before. As we said, you know, before we started recording, you know, I had covered the 2012 volleyball team that was a national champion runner-up, and they were a good team, but so far it seems like there's something special about this team.
Well, they're 10 matches into, I think, a 26-match season. They finished the non-conference part of their schedule. It went, I think, pretty well. That, you know, they won their first two matches against UC Davis and Rice. Then they went out to the Big Ten and played in Minneapolis, and they lost to two ranked teams, Minnesota and Penn State. But ever since then, they haven't lost a match, and they barely lost a set. They went to Coral Gables to play a couple of East Coast teams, South Carolina, Miami, and won both of those 3-0 and then 3-1. And then they came back to the West Coast. They started out conference play against Corvallis, in Corvallis against Oregon State, won that one 3-1. And since then, they haven't dropped a single set. They swept all three of their matches at home last weekend, or the weekend before last, against number 5 Stanford, swept them at home. That was really impressive. And then this weekend, they swept both of the Arizona schools, Arizona State and Arizona. So, I mean, they've played six, or they played four, conference matches so far. They've only dropped a single set, you know, and that was on the road at Corvallis. Like, this team's real hot right now.
They are. And, this is a special team that benefits from, not only, having a solid veteran like, Brooke Nunaviller, who does everything. I mean, she started out defensively earlier in her Oregon career, and now is not only an excellent defensive player, but she's regularly one of the kill leaders. And Oregon benefits from having newcomers that have an excellent combination of height and athleticism. And when you watch the Ducks on TV, having the camera follow the ball really doesn't do a service to Oregon when you see how fast these players are, see how they do kills and go for defensive digs. This is a really athletic team, and they benefit not only from having the inexperienced veteran like Nunaviller, but Mimi Collier is she just earned her fifth freshman of the week honors, only the fifth freshman in Pac-12 history to earn those kind of honors. And she's a lot like Nina Viller. She blocks well. She has height. She does. She has wicked kills, but she's also a great defender. You know, she'll be regularly in double digits on digs, and like Nina Viller, Collier can deliver a backcourt kill like nobody's business.
Yeah, you put a couple of clips of that in your article. Your article is a real pleasure to read. It's still up on the site for anybody who missed it. The Oregon volleyball sweeps the state of Arizona. It is a comprehensive article. It includes a ton of Twitter video clips that are really just amazing and super fun to watch. It includes a bunch of original photos that only appear in Addicted to Quack. It just really looked like a blast. And you're right. Like, some of those distance kills look really great. I was also like, the player who really caught my eye, we had talked earlier about Hannah Pukas, as, you know, a real up and comer, for the team, but the mm-hmm. the player who really like caught my eye, from reviewing your article was Gloria Mutieri.
Yes. Boy,
she's incredible.
Yeah. She is, and I would like to get a speed gun on her kills, because she's got some serious velocity, and she has this wicked kill that goes cross-court. Yep, she's on the right side. She'll hit a cross-court kill just right on the other side of the net, and it's extremely difficult to defend. It's very fast, and what that creates is if you're defending that, then you're leaving a gap elsewhere, like behind the defender, and she'll go for that. But she's got some great velocity. It's all I can do to resist getting a micrometer out there and measuring the circumference of the ball, because I know from the heat coming off that hit, it has expanded.
you also included a little a video in which they had an interview with Mutieri, and that was real fun to listen to as well. It really strikes me that they're having fun too. Like, that's the other thing that I sort of like get out of this team is that like they are, I know this might sound corny or something like that, but like they, like when they get a kill, they are really, they're, it's not like this like cool professionalism, which is another, which I do appreciate sometimes, but they're just like, they are screaming and hugging each other and supporting each other. And it's like, that was really fun to see. And like, even though okay, is there a star of this team? Cause we've just named like five different, people,
Right. That's the thing, is you're not depending on just one or two people for your kill production. Kiari Roby, gets kills in there. Kobe Neal may have some of the fastest reactions that I've ever seen. There was a couple of times where she did a block and instantly reacted. She'd done a kill and it was blocked, and she instantly reacted to the block in a way that, other players would just miss. One of them was went off court, but the other reaction was a kill. I mean, it was boom, boom. It was that fast.
The other thing that's interesting about this team is that it's very young, right? Like, a lot of freshmen, and like start, not just like the backbenchers or whatever, like the it's a ton of production out of freshmen. And like, they're going to be there for the long haul. You know, like, you settle in, Oregon fans, you're going to have a good volleyball team for at least, you know, a couple of years. And this season's not even half over yet. So, like, yeah, if you're not into volleyball yet, like, get into it. Like, almost all of these games are going to be televised. You know, at least the next four, Washington State, Washington, USC, UCLA, are all going to be on Pac-12 or ESPN. It's real fast paced. I actually find that I enjoy it more than watching the beach volleyball, because, like, with only two players, there's the kills happen, you know, real quick in beach volleyball, and you're like fighting the sand, which I guess is part of the point. But like the indoor volleyball, you know, it's five person teams. The rallies tend to go for a while, and like every time the ball crosses the net, it's like it ratchets up the excitement, you know, even more. It just feels like more and more frenetic. You know, the announcers are really good. I know that you've been at the games, but I've been watching them at home, and like I don't know who it is that they've got calling these games, but they are like super sharp, and they're machine cutting out the calls. It's definitely, you know, I'm chiefly into football. I openly admit that. But in terms of like, and many other sports, you know, sometimes I find myself nodding off a little bit because they're a little slower paced, right? You know, soccer takes forever. Baseball and softball famously take forever. I prefer softball to baseball because it's only got seven innings and it's over quick. Volleyball is extremely fast. There's, you know, nobody's standing around. Nobody's like debating who's going to get the beach ball off of the court. You know, like it is lightning fast. It is super exciting, and Oregon's real good. So you should get into volleyball. That's my review.
You're right. They're, Oregon's been playing good teams, and good teams defend well, so you get these incredible long rallies, and you just wonder how it's going to come out. And really, Oregon doesn't always win those rallies, but to see that effort on both sides is just something to see.
The other thing that I'll say, you know, for advertising the team, then we'll wrap up, is that almost all of their matches, they're you know, they're paired, and they they'll play the LA schools, then they'll play the Arizona schools, and they'll play the Washington schools, and they take place, they bookend football on Saturday, so it's Friday then Sunday. So like, you can get your Oregon sports, you know, fall sports, you get to watch, you know, volleyball and then football and then volleyball again. And it's like, it's a nice bookend, and it, you know, works well with the schedule. I've been, you know, I've been watching these volleyball games on Sunday while I do my film study of the Oregon football game. And like, that's peanut butter and chocolate, man. They go together really well. So I highly recommend the experience. If you're an NFL fan and you got two screens, put on an NFL game on one screen and volleyball on the other. It's great.
Yeah, and if you're in Eugene and have the time to see a volleyball game, it's not going to be a four-hour affair out of your time, and the tickets are really reasonable. There isn't a bad seat in the house.
Well, the next four matches, you know, this coming weekend and the weekend after that are going to be on the road. They got Washington State and then Washington in Pullman and then Seattle this weekend on Friday the 7th and then Sunday the 9th. And then the next weekend, they're playing the LA schools in LA, USC first and then UCLA on Sunday. But then they're back in Eugene in late October to take on the Mountain schools, Utah, then Colorado on the 21st and the 23rd. And get a ticket, go support the team. It's flat.
Yeah. And on these, next two road trips, the next two weekends, we're going to get a sense of what kind of road warriors this team is, because it's really easy to get, charged up in a friendly environment with, a loud crowd. And, in Matthew Knight Arena, there's always a vocal crowd for volleyball. You get into some of these other places like Pullman and a not friendly crowd, and you know, the emotions can play differently. So it'll be interesting to see how this volleyball squad rises up to the challenge of being on the road.
Well, if we talked you into becoming a volleyball fan listener, the best primer that you can do is to read Bad Water's most recent article. The volleyball team sweeps the Arizona schools, because it really walks you through the team and who the stars are. Lots of great clips to sort of show you how the team plays. It was just a fantastic article. I can't praise it highly enough. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about football's win over Stanford. So kind of got the monkey off the back, wouldn't you say?
Yep. Yeah. Two monkeys. Yeah. Yeah. Cause we can't forget Wazoo. Pullman's always a tough place to play, and Stanford always, in the past anyway, has seemed to find a way to stick it to us. And that most certainly did not happen.
Just objectively, like, Wazoo is a much less talented team. And yet, you know, playing in Pullman is always, like, weirdly scary. And Stanford, I mean, it's been a terrible team since, like, 2018. And yet, you know, they beat the Ducks twice, you know, in that time, including, you know, their Oregon's most recent loss in Autzen Stadium. So it's like, yeah, you know, that one felt pretty good. Although, you know, having done the film study on Stanford, this one was even more predictable of a win than in previous years. That team is, oh my God, it's real bad right now. They're in real trouble.
Yeah. And if you read the Stanford Q&A, Channel 3 Sports does shed a little bit of light on what's going on. You know, Stanford is kind of behind the eight ball, and not of their own doing, but you know, the entrance requirements to get into Stanford and get a degree are super high, and they also suffer from not really having the NIL backing that other schools like USC or Washington or Oregon are going to have.
Yeah, I think the NIL thing is the least of their problems. I mean, hell, like, going to Stanford is kind of a, you know, having a Stanford degree is kind of a license to print money. But like, early signing day really screwed them, you know, because it took away their ability to sort of swoop in and give a Stanford offer, which is how they stole a bunch of recruits over the years. It means they can't really take transfers, and their grad school's been messing with them and not, like, guaranteeing, you know, players a fifth year in school. And, like, these are all, like, roadblocks that I do still ultimately blame the Stanford administration for these situations, because these were not insurmountable problems if they had a cooperative administration who, like, really wanted football to be successful. But, you know, they haven't really cleared out those roadblocks, you know, probably because that's not the case. And the other piece of evidence that the administration is not really serious about football is that David Shaw should have had a fire lit under his ass a long time ago. Like, this slide would be unacceptable at any other school, not just in the Pac-12, but across the country. Like, any other school would have fired David Shaw after this a while ago, or at the very least, like, you know, point blank told them, you need to, you know, fire this crew of assistant coaches who are all dead weight at this point. And, you know, because that's the only thing that's going to save your job right now. But, like, Stanford hasn't made a single change in their coaching. And they're one of, I believe, only five FBS teams who did not change their coaching staff at all this, you know, last offseason.
They're kind of in a hole of their own digging. Yep. They created it. So, you know, sorry you jumped in without a rope, but
and it's like, you know, and then I can tell you from doing film, I mean, it was really interesting doing film study on them, because, like, they swiped Wake Forest's offense, and usually when you switch, you know, offensive schemes, it's because you hired somebody from that staff to bring it over, you know, not David Shaw. He just watched a bunch of TV and copied their, you know, system by watching it, you know, monkey see, monkey do, you know, kind of, you know, deal. And it's not, I mean, Wake Forest has done fairly well with it, but like Wake Forest has some advantages that Stanford doesn't. Like their offensive line can hold up long enough for the slow mesh to work, and somebody in the comments of my article, I think it might have been Tristan, made the comment that this was a system that, like, if they were going to change systems, it's like they changed it based on what they think their school is good at rather than what they are actually good at.
Rather than set up something that fits the personnel that you have.
It was Tristan. I found the comment. Actually, Tristan was a really insightful comment that he's got in the middle of that comment section. Okay, dude, you're changing your offense because you know your offensive line can't run block anymore. So you picked a system that is also super demanding of your offensive line, because they have to hold up for this super slow mesh. Like, what are you doing, dude? And on top of that, like, what their offense is really good at, where they do actually have some real actual scary talent, is these super big undefendable wide receivers running down the sideline in one-on-one coverage, because you can't one-on-one cover them because they're so huge and they'll box you out. But then they adopted a route tree that doesn't have them doing that. It has them running, slants in the middle of the field, in which you can use underneath coverage and other things in order to defend them. And on top of that, you built a bunch of keys into your system so that if you have a smart, defensive mind, they can crack those keys and force the offense to do what the defense wants. And like Stanford's real good rule followers, they're not going to break the rules, And so that was the thing that was, totally remarkable. Like, I got to do 2 games worth of film study on this team, which was sort of weird going into week 5 game, because they had a bye. And then also in their opener against FCS Colgate, they didn't run this offense. They sprang it on USC in week 2, which was, crazy. Neither USC nor Washington really, they defeated Stanford, but neither of them really cracked the code on this. And so I'm sitting there watching those 2 games. And like what I wrote in my film study preview of the team, was that, okay, I figured out how you beat this offense. It's not that difficult, not really. But what you do is you basically always induce them to run, and so basically you back out your defenders so that they run the ball, and then you trust your line in order to stop that run. And given that Stanford's offensive line is no good, that shouldn't be that difficult. But like, here's the other piece of data, which is that like Wake Forest, which originated this offense, it's actually... contrary, I think, to a lot of people's or fans' beliefs about coaches, they are usually very, very open with each other about like, what are they running? What are they doing? Even with opponents, even with guys who are on their schedule, if you just ask them like, so what, problems have you encountered installing this offense? It's like a fraternity of coaches, and they really talk to each other and they like nerding out, and they go on coaches clinics and will like video record themselves teaching all coaches around the country and anybody who wants to pay for it. Like, here's how we run our offense, and here's what all our keys are. Or here's our defense, and here's the rat in the hole. Saban has this whole thing about the rat in the hole defense, which is just like mind-blowing. It's like, here, I'm going to teach you how to run a national championship level defense with all the details that you could possibly want, and you just have to pay like $19 to get access to all this tape. It was just like crazy how much these guys share. Except Wake Forest has not gone on the coaches circuit, and when people ask them what are the keys to your offense, there's I'm not going to tell you, which that's interesting. So anyway, David Shaw then, watches it on television and copies it. And then, Coach Lanning and the rest of his staff, watch those 2 games. And me, I'm not on staff, but I was doing an independent project. Because Wake Forest won't tell you, and Dan Lanning wouldn't tell me, and David Shaw wouldn't tell me. And certainly not the commentators on television, because they couldn't possibly know. So I couldn't I couldn't quite figure it out. Two games was probably not enough for me. I think maybe if I had a few more games, I might be able to figure it out, but I'm just like, I'm not a professional. Sorry. I'm an amateur and I'm an idiot. So basically I said, okay, I can't figure out who the individual player is that's getting red, but I know that it's one of these four guys. So you should just back out all four of them, you know, back up both of the linebackers and both of the safeties. And then you're definitely going to get a run and you can trust your four, you know, defensive linemen or three defensive linemen plus OLB to stop this run. And Lanning was like, oh, I'll do you one better. I'll run that strategy, right? That was exactly what they did. They induced Stanford to run every single time, except one where I think Stevens screws up and comes up on the run. And sure enough, Stanford hits an RPO slant right over him, which like, that's what they want to do. Then don't do that, Steve. So anyway, every single time, except for that one in the first half, they induced Stanford to run. And that's why Stanford has like no passing numbers in this game, or at least in the first half. That's why Oregon's forcing them to run every time. And then, but here's the thing. Lanning was like, I'll figure out exactly who the individual player is. You know, it's going to be Hill on this play, and it's going to be Bassa on this play, and it's going to be this guy on this other play, and this guy on this other play. And so that dude will back out to induce the run, but all the other available dudes will have them crash down on the run. And so like Stanford's lousy offensive line is trying to block like seven dudes, which they can't, you know, possibly do. And I was just like, it was simultaneously really gratifying to have like successfully identified what the winning strategy was going to be, like in general terms, but also like super cool to watch a professional at work who's like, yeah, I'm this much better than you that I can identify who the actual individual kid is going to be.
Right. And it was self-defeating for Stanford because the only way Stanford was ever going to be able to keep up with Oregon was if they could establish a passing game with some explosive passing plays. And that never happened.
Yeah. And I mean, McKee is a really good quarterback, I think. Like, I think that he's an NFL-ready quarterback, to be perfectly honest, or at least when it's time for him to go to the NFL, he will be, of all of the current Pac-12 quarterbacks, I think he will be the most desirable one for what the NFL wants out of quarterbacks. I know that sentence was fairly complicated, but, like, yeah, he's a good pocket passer. And he's got all the measurables, and he's really tall, and he's really decisive, and he throws a very tight, very nice spiral. But like Stanford's current offensive structure won't let him do that. And Stanford's current offensive line will give him a clean pocket, and it's not like he's a scrambler. He's a real statue. And so like his numbers this year are going to suck, and then he's going to get drafted in like the first or second round, and people are going to say, what, why? And I'll be like, I know. But yeah, you were absolutely right. That's how Stanford was going to win the game, that's how they were going to win it. And Oregon gave them no opportunity to do so, which sort of feels like a Y2K thing. Like, I hope that our listeners are old enough to remember that. Maybe not. Maybe they were born after Y2K, but like, you know, everybody freaked out about Y2K, and then, you know, all the programmers did something about it so that Y2K was no big deal. And then there were some, like, you know, wise guys who were like, oh, look at you silly goofballs who were freaking out about it, you know, even though it was no big deal. It's like, it was no big deal because they freaked out about it, you know? And so, like, you know, I feel like this game was like that. It was like Oregon properly freaked out about the possibility of Stanford passing the ball and so didn't let them do it. And so the final box score looks like Stanford can't pass the ball very well. But boy, I'm here to tell you, they can. If Oregon's defense didn't play him right, they could have taken Oregon apart with their passing game, because McKee's really good and they've got a bunch of undefendable wide receivers. But Oregon's defensive, you know, those guys are sharp. They knew what they were doing, and they kept Stanford from being able to do that. So, yay.
Yeah. And when Stanford could generate offense, they were playing against our backups and the game was out of hand.
Yeah, so, right. You know, all the second half. I mean, the second half was all garbage time.
That's what happens. Yeah.
I'm putting it on the pile. Hopefully Oregon will put a couple of other teams in garbage time, so I'll have a nice big pile in the off season to go through of all, you know, that whole garbage tape to look at. Well, because, you know, looking at the backups is useful. Like, you know, this year's backups from next year's starters, you know.
Yeah.
So like having that project to go through, you know, that was one of the things about the Mario Cristobal era. Even though I think I'm probably I'm A lot of people, a lot of Oregon fans, and I understand why, are, you know, real mad at Mario Cristobal, and I think sort of are letting their feelings about the way that the Mario Cristobal era ended, you know, bleed, sort of retroactively color the way that they perceived his entire time at Oregon, and are like, this was an entirely garbage. And I'm like, you know, yeah, like, it was clearly not entirely garbage. Like, look at the records. It's obviously not.
Yeah. You know, he won games, and he built on Taggart's recruiting and took recruiting to a new level.
But
Lanning wasn't starting at square one.
Yeah, definitely. If you like the way that this season is going, you know, thank Dan Lanning, but also thank Mario Cristobal, because he's the guy who set this up, set up all this talent. Yeah. But anyway, that wasn't the point of this was not to praise Mario Cristobal. It was to say, even though I'm a person who I feel like is more rational than many in assessing the strengths of the Mario Cristobal era, there's one area that really frustrated me, which is that dude was not blowing people out, and not necessarily, I think, because he couldn't, but because he was deliberately adopting strategies that were like, I'm going to maximize my chance of winning, even though it reduces the, you know, giant margin of victory and means that we're playing our starters all the way through to the fourth quarter. So in the Mario Cristobal era, I never accumulated a big mountain of garbage time tape to look at in the off season. I got a little bit here and there, but it was like against Nevada or whatever. Like, I'm getting garbage time tape against teams like BYU and Stanford and, you know, folks who recruit, you know, actual athletes. And when they still have their starters out on the field in the fourth quarter playing against Oregon's backups, like, that's useful tape. Like, of course, the starters for the opponent against the Oregon backups are going to do well. That's why you call it garbage time and you exclude it from the data. But in terms of like testing, you know, where they're at athletically and developmentally, like, ooh, yeah, I'm looking forward to that project, and I'm looking forward to having a big pile of that film, you know, to go through.
Yeah. And, as is evidenced by the comments on the Addicted to Quack, website, and also one's own eyes, the calls for Ty Thompson coming into the game have significantly quieted down. Because he's kind of demonstrated why he's not the number one.
I haven't done any film study on it, you know, like, I, because it's garbage time, and I'm, like I said, I'm saving it. But like, it's certainly true, I can say from watching casually, that like, while he's been in, Oregon's offense has not moved the ball, and you know, it's hard not to draw, you know, the line between those two facts.
Yeah. And, but that's, you know, him being in the game is not a bad thing. One presumes that Dillingham is instructing him and developing him. And, you know, he's getting an opportunity to make mistakes and learn from that.
Yeah, and making mistakes during live game reps against Power 5 caliber, you know, starters. I can't imagine anything more valuable.
And not impact the W.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't even impact, you know, covering the spread. So, if Ty Thompson is going to work out, I guess I'll put it this way. If in a year's time or longer, you know, we're watching Ty Thompson kick butt, you can think back to right now and say, okay, I'm glad that they made that decision. Or it may never happen, and they learn that, you know, Thompson is not ever going to do that, and they move on to Butterfield or Dante Moore as a true freshman or something else. You know, like, either way, it's valuable, you know, and you don't get any value out of that if you're not putting teams into garbage time, and you're not putting teams into garbage time unless, you know, you are doing all the things in the first half to make that happen, which they've been doing. So, the other thing that's been really impressive about Oregon in the last, well, basically every game, including against Georgia, is that the rushing offense is just unstoppable. You know, you combine a really good, really veteran offensive line, a scheme that is, you know, uses them well, you know, which is creative and isn't just, you know, I-formation runs 300 times. And with, you know, some very good running backs, you know, who are, you know, making cuts and making guys miss. And, you know, if the hole's not there, you know, they bounce outside.
Right. And they're showing some patience. Both Irving and Whittingham. Whittington. Aren't just running into the backs of their blockers. Irving, especially on a few plays, you know, shows a lot of patience in letting his blockers develop a gap or, you know, to make a decision whether to make a cut because in front of me ain't working.
And they're really eager to bounce it outside, which actually part of me as a film reviewer who really just wants to see the play executed properly. Like, I'm sort of like, I want to see you run through the gap that was supposed to be there. But then he gets like 20 yards and I'm like, all right, I'll just forget it. you know,
I guess I'll accept that.
Yeah. Right. They're very good backs. And you know, and so Oregon has been recording. Well, here I plan on during the bye week, which is coming up after they play Arizona, I plan on publishing an article that's a mid-season, you know, like let's look at all the stats to date. But here's what I've got through week five. Through week five, all games inclusive, so that, you know, including, you know, Georgia, also including Eastern Washington, although these numbers don't really change. There's really only one thing that changes if you, and that's Oregon's defensive numbers look a lot better if you exclude Georgia. That's it. But anyway, Oregon's offensive rush efficiency, including all games, but again, doesn't really change no matter who you exclude, but all games is 67%, like on the nose. It's 77 wins to 38 fails, which, like, that's 60% is championship caliber, 50% is you know, is average. So it's a 10-point gap between, you know, average and championship, and they're 7 points higher than that. That's incredible. You know, the opening line in my film review article of Stanford is that there's this old football truism that if you can run the ball effectively, the rest of the game is irrelevant, you know, because you can play defense through your running game and you can, you know, make up for a sputtering pass offense through your running game, or you can make your pass offense better through your running game by setting up play action. And, you know, you can control the ball, you can sit on a lead, you can prevent the opponent from, you know, from getting the ball and executing their offense, except, you know, in a really sort of desperate, you know, low time manner. Like if you can run the ball, like at 67% clip or higher, you know, like, you know, excluding Georgia, it's even higher. It's 69.3. You know, if you can run the ball at that clip and it sort of looks like Oregon's going to be able to for the rest of the season, it's really hard to lose a game. You know, for the opponent to beat you, their window to do so becomes very small, and they basically have to play perfectly, and they basically need to get, you know, all their lucky bounces need to go their way, which, like, I don't know, I reviewed the Wazoo tape, and you know, that's sort of what that looks like. You know, like that game is what a team that on the fundamentals is killing their opponent, but then on all the wacky stuff, like when the refs decide to throw flags and when they decide not to, you know, trick plays, you know, weird red zone decisions, like, that's what that looks like. And Oregon still prevailed, you know, and prevailed because Wazoo couldn't, you know, among other reasons, because, you know, Wazoo couldn't stop the run. And neither could Stanford. And even though Oregon in this game against Stanford only had a 50-50 pass efficiency, you know, like, for, you know, there were some drops and Knicks, you know, forced a couple of passes, and, you know, it was just sort of like,
got really lucky because two of them should true. Be interceptions.
I mean, that is but, definitely true. It's the number one remaining concern that I have about this team is Nix is like keeps putting the ball in danger, you know, on, you know, not every pass, not even, you know, most passes, or, but it's, you know, once a game he puts the ball in danger, you know, and sometimes you get that gets picks off and that can be game changer. You know, it's definitely my number one remaining concern about the team. But, you know, that aside, having, you know, they ran at 80% efficiency. They passed at 50% efficiency. The game was over at halftime at 31-3. That's the importance of running the ball.
Yep. Yes, indeed. And running it well and not the way Cristobal ran the ball, which I think delights a lot of Oregon fans.
Yeah, I think, well, the one thing that's definitely different about the two is, well, I don't know if it's Cristobal or not. I actually think it's the backs more than it is Cristobal, but just those things coincide, right? Like Cristobal had two backs for basically his entire time at Oregon, who were Dye and Verdell. And I can tell you from doing film study on those guys, it took them until their last year at Oregon to develop the vision and patience to do what Whittington and Irving are doing right now. Now, Oregon got both of those guys as transfers. You know, they also come to Oregon later in their careers. I think that Carlos Laughlin is a really good running backs coach. I don't know if he's a better running backs coach than Jim Mastro was for Oregon under Cristobal. You know, I don't know if Mastro was unable to teach vision and patience to Verdell and Dye, or if those guys were just like needed more time to pick it up. I just honestly don't know. There's too many variables for me to like pin down and say, aha. But if you wanted to say this running offense is more fun to watch than the Cristobal era running offense and you know, but who knows what the causality is? Sure, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. That's the case. You know, I'm just a little, you know, leery of establishing causality because, you know, like I said, there's too many variables. But like, yeah, it's definitely fun to watch those guys run. The other upshot of that,
or Oregon fans aren't going to care. It's more fun to watch. They're not really going to care about causality.
But, I mean, Oregon, it's honestly, a lot of it is just really the offensive line, which is another thing you should thank Mario Cristobal, you know, era for. I guess I'm the Cristobal apologist. I don't really want to be pigeonholed in that way. But like, I mean, Oregon last year was running at about a 75, you know, I think they finished the season on like 71% rush efficiency. And that's with, you know, three of the last four games looking really ugly. You know, so like the fact that that's carried over to this year is like not really a surprise because, you know, okay, the running backs coach is different. The running backs are all different, but the coaching staff is all different. You know, the offense and the offensive coordinator is different, but you know what's not different? The offensive line.
The line, yeah.
Because the line is what makes the run game.
Yeah, big experienced bodies there in depth.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll look a little ways forward to the Arizona football matchup. So, Badwater, have you watched any of Arizona football this year?
I have not. I've watched most of the other Pac-12 teams. I haven't watched any Arizona or Arizona State. I've watched the Huskies, watched part of the Cal game, USC and the Beavers, of course, you know, UCLA. But I have not watched Arizona yet.
I know that our sister site, Arizona Desert Swarm, contacted you and you're going to be exchanging a Q&A with them.
Yes.
You want to give us a little sneak preview?
Well, the kind of questions that I asked Desert Swarm mostly had to do with how they think they're going to be looking at success or progress this year. We're in the,
because it's a team coming off of a 1-11 season, you know.
Right. And it's Fish's, you know, Jed Fish's second season. They're coming up into a real Pac-12 gauntlet.
Oh yeah, there sure are.
We're the first of a string of, you know, teams that they're going to have trouble defeating. You know, Washington and Utah and UCLA, and now Wazoo and us. And
yeah, I mean, so, they get Arizona State at the end of the year, of course, in the Territorial Cup. And like, now that Arizona State is like a headless horseman, you know, they're probably licking their chops at some revenge, you know, against the Sun Devils for that game. But like, other than that, they probably got their two most winnable, you know, games at the very beginning of their, you know, conference play in Cal and Colorado, and they split them. You know, Cal beat them. And yeah, as you say, you know, I mean, everybody else on their schedule, I mean, it's kind of a nightmare for them. You know, because it's Oregon, Washington, USC, Utah, UCLA, Washington State. Like, I don't want to play those teams if I'm Arizona. Right. Like,
you know. Yeah. So, I'll be interested in seeing, what Desert Swarm has to say about, you know, how do you measure progress, or any kind of success when you're probably looking at six losses?
I mean, it's just sort of brutal. You know, they don't play Stanford out of the North. I think Oregon State's the other team that they miss, which, like, I'm not quite sure what to think about Oregon State yet. It's the last team of the year for Oregon, and I haven't done any film study on them yet. It just hasn't like come up in the course of like watching other teams that I'm getting ready for. So, although I think I have to do, they just played Utah, and Oregon's playing Utah in the near future. So, you know, that one's coming up, but like, I'm not sure what to think about Oregon State, whether that was potentially a winnable game for Arizona, but irrelevant. They're not playing them. You know, they don't play Stanford, and that probably, you know, might've been a winnable game. They lost against Cal, and I have done film study on that. I've done film study on all five of their games that they played. They opened against San Diego State. You know who San Diego State's starting quarterback is, Badwater?
I don't.
It is one Braxton Burmeister.
Oh, I recognize that name.
Somehow he still has eligibility. He has been a starting quarterback now at three different schools.
I have noticed that San Diego State is so far not having quite the season that they had hoped for.
Braxton Burmeister hasn't become a better quarterback. He really hasn't. In fact, it's interesting. You don't see this very often. It's one of the things that's interesting about doing film, like charting teams, is that they generally, when it comes to their, you know, efficiency in all four quadrants of football, so, you know, rush offense, pass offense, rush defense, pass defense, generally for every team against every opponent, with obviously some exceptions, like, you know, you're playing an FCS team, or you're playing, you know, the number one team in America, like, then you'll get some distortion to the numbers. But generally, if you're playing, you know, anybody from number 10 to number, you know, 100, you know, the vast mushy middle of college football, your efficiency numbers don't really change. But Arizona's sort of been an exception in their pass defense. Against Mississippi State, North Dakota State, and Cal, their pass defense is about 43%, you know, meaning the opponent is succeeding on 57% of their, you know, their design passing plays. Against San Diego State and Colorado, their pass defense jumps to like 63%, which, like, that's a big swing, you know, like that it's really big, you know, like a 16-point swing, which is crazy. And I mean, the reason is because San Diego State, it's Braxton Burmeister in Colorado. It's Owen McCown, who's a true freshman making his second start on a staff that just got fired, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, man. So like their pass efficiency comes out, or pass defense efficiency comes out to 50%, but it's because they have three bad games and two good games, not because they are a perfectly average team. I think they are actually a pretty bad pass defense that's just played to even worse quarterbacks. Right. And then their rush defense is terrible. Like, it's just, I mean, this is, you know, Arizona is going to wind up looking like a bunch of teams that Oregon plays where like their rush defense is terrible. Their pass defense is as good as the quarterback, plays them is bad. Their offense, you know, they're not really effective running the ball, but they do have a real scrambly quarterback who can make magic happen. And like that, I mean, honestly, that describes like six teams that Oregon is going to play.
yeah, and you mentioned that in your Stanford film recap that, you know, Stanford's rush defense wasn't terribly great. But neither is Colorado's or Arizona's. Bad.
Yeah, Arizona and Colorado both, like in their raw stats anyway, are they're even worse than Stanford. Arizona actually grades out better in advanced stats against the run than Stanford does, but not by a whole lot. And that's almost entirely because Stanford was like abysmally bad at like 25%. Whereas Arizona is 36%, which is better, but it's below, you know, so like average is 50%. And then like one standard deviation down is 40% and another standard deviation up is 60%. So if you're below 40%, that means you are now more than one standard deviation worse than average, which means you're real, real bad. You know, so Stanford being like 2.5 Stanford standard deviations, you know, from average, that indicates like, oh my God, you know, and, but you know, in Arizona is only 1.5. So like, but that's still pretty, oh my God, you know, like,
right. Yeah. And, yeah, I caught the hint of what you were alluding to, which is that, we're going to see, an Oregon offense that leans again on its successful running game.
Yeah. I mean, if the scariest thing about your opponent is, you know, what the quarterback can do in the passy / scrambly / I'm going to make some weird stuff happen game, then the best way to guarantee a win is to keep the ball out of the opposing quarterback's hands. And what's the best way to do that?
Ball control.
Run the ball. Run yep. the ball. I mean, if you can run the ball, I mean, the reason why I referenced that truism about, you know, running the ball means that the rest of the game is relevant is because running the ball, you know, is an answer to any problem that you have in football. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you need to eat clock, run the ball. It's third and long, run the ball twice. You know, yeah. you know, your pass offense, not what it needs to be, you know, run the ball. It doesn't matter what your problem is. The answer is run the ball. And nobody can stop Oregon running the ball. So, like, yeah, you know, yeah, Ducks fans, you know, get used to this. Like, you're going to see it. You're going to see it until they play a team that can't stop the run, which, like, maybe they don't play that team ever. But if they do, it's not going to be until, like, mid-November. So run the ball. Mm-hmm. You're going to see it a lot. Yeah. And isn't it nice they've got, like, 5 running backs? You know, so that yeah. like, you know, that each of them can remain fresh or somebody can take a week or two off to get over a little nagging injury. Like, you know, in that complaint that Oregon Ducks fans had, it was like, oh, this running back room is too big. I don't like it, man. Why do they have so many running backs? Like, doesn't that seem real dumb right now? Like,
yeah. Well, they have a deep running back room and, you know, all 5 of the main running backs are capable of doing something.
Yeah. They're I mean, how
capable of going out and getting some yards. I don't see a weak link there really.
So Sean Dollars in this game only got a couple of touches, but they're hilarious to me. He gets, you know, like I said, I didn't have a whole lot of clips to choose from for a pass offense success. But Sean Dollars has 2 catches in the flats back to back that actually illustrated a nice, you know, changeup where he gets split out as a receiver. One play, he's in the slot and runs a switch route against man, which, like, you definitely want to run switch against man. It creates sort of a natural rub, and he catches the ball for like 6 yards. And then the next play, 2nd and 4, he lines up not in the slot, but as the X. And Stanford backs out to zone, but they're like, Sean Ehlers can run real fast. I better bail deep. And so he just runs 6 yards, catches the flat pass, you know, gets another couple extra, you know, it's like 8 yards and a first down, you know, it's like, yeah, that's how you're supposed to use, you know, like that's using the running back as a wide receiver, playing him different versus, you know, whether the defense is in zone versus man, you know, picking up free access throws to the sideline, which Stanford's film indicated that their covered shells almost always leave open. Just like, yeah, you know, he gets two passes and both of them are pretty damn good gains. And then he gets like basically one run in the first half. It's 3rd and 21. This is the play that comes after the penalty for Seven McGee fighting, which that was weird. So it's 3rd and 21 on, I think, the Stanford 22. And so Stanford is backed out to play the pass. Cause like, why wouldn't they on 3rd and 21? And Sean Ehlers gets the ball and he runs for 20 yards. Now, if you get 20 yards on 3rd and 21, that's a failed play, right? You didn't convert the third down. And so I included it in my article as like, here's one of the few failed running plays. It's when Sean Ehlers, who didn't get that many touches, runs for 20 yards. Uh-huh. I mean, it was hilarious.
And for the past few games, Oregon's been outstanding on fourth down. Conversions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They get conversions and they're not afraid to do it.
Yeah.
Which means previous incarnations would have been.
Which means that your third down play calling is liberated, right? Like, is it 3rd and long? Run the ball, all set up 4th and 4, maybe. I'll run the ball again. You know, like you ain't going to stop Oregon's run game two plays in a row. It's not with these numbers. Yeah. So like, go ahead and run it twice, you know, on third, then fourth down. Now in this particular instance, even though it was going to be 4th and 1 and they might've had to make a decision. First of all, there was no decision to make. If you're on the 2 yard line, you go for it. Like that's ridiculous to try to kick a field goal. You know, that's so stupid. Like the analytics will scream and blink red at you if you kick a field goal when you're on 4th and, you know, in 2 yards to the goal line. But second of all, Stanford got an unsportsmanlike conduct on that one where the safety who transferred from Oklahoma is real mad at the umpire for picking him during the play, which like I kind of understood the umpire kept getting in his way. It was funny watching him like jump up and down like a cartoon character screaming, you know, about that. These refs were fairly flag happy, you know, like a lot of things they called on Oregon were appropriate. And yes. I've heard a rumor that Stanford was using disconcerting signals and that's why Oregon had so many false starts, which I can't verify, but you know, nonetheless, but what I can verify from watching the film was, yes, that was definitely a false start. Like, you know, the rest didn't imagine that. And, you know, a couple others too, but then a bunch of others.
Yeah, just the unsportsmanlike, we tossed the football
at the Stanford player. Stupid.
Accidentally or not, that's going to get you the flag.
But it was so clear that it was an accident, you know, like, and it was that totally within the ref's discretion to recognize that that's an accident and not throw the flag. And yet they did, you know, and against the Stanford in the play that I just mentioned, it's within his discretion to tell the kid to shut up and get back and play defense and not throw the flag, but they wanted to throw the flag.
And there was at least one other instance where Oregon kind of dodged an unsportsmanlike bullet. I'm thinking specifically about where Christian Gonzalez does a great defensive deflection right in front of the Stanford sideline, sits down, crosses his arm, and glares
at
a few feet away from him. That didn't get a flag.
I was thinking the same thing. Although the fighting one about Seven McGee, I was actually curious about that one. And I watched the tape closely and he actually does earn that. He smacks a kid's helmet. And he's the first guy who throws a smack too. So like,
But it should be offsetting because Stanford has Bo Nix's helmet and they toss it.
Yeah, and you know,
there should have been
listen, we can litigate the penalties all day long. I think it sort of suffices to say that this crew of referees on many discretionary plays, they always or almost always chose to throw the flag on somebody, and that it was very clear that had sort of a disruptive effect on the momentum of the game. You know, that there were so many flags thrown. You know, like teams sort of, I know this sort of sounds a little wishy-washy but like it's real, you know, teams thrive on momentum, you know, like they sequence plays, you know, they use tempo, and like when the refs are constantly interrupting the game, you know, valid or not is that's irrelevant to my point. My point is that like when there's a lot of laundry on the field, your momentum sort of gets disrupted, and that can have an effect on the game. And I think it did, you know, affect this game.
Yeah, and before we get to thinking that Oregon's being picked on or something, I just think there's a lot of bad refereeing going on in Pac-12 football. I watched most of the USC Oregon State game, and USC held there. USC held there. USC held there. That was pass interference. Why isn't USC getting called for this?
I mean, Oregon State's defensive line was just chewing up USC's offensive line, and they, you know, whenever that happens, it should be generating a bunch of holding flags. Like, even if I didn't watch that game, if I just knew the number of scrambles, you can generally predict the number of holding flags that come out of it, because there's a correlation between those two. And, you know, in that game, the number of scrambles versus the number of holding flags was a much higher number than the general you know, trend would predict. Let's leave it at that. All right, that's enough complaining about that. We're doing a lot of complaining for a blowout win. My article about doing film study on Arizona will be published on Friday morning. You know, I've already done all the film study on it, but I have yet to do my podcast interview with Adam Green of AZ Desert Swarm, one of our sister sites on the SB Nation network. We're recording that on Tuesday, so it should be out on Thursday. So that should either be on Thursday night or Friday morning. And it'll be, you know, linked as part of my article on Friday morning with my, you know, film study preview of Arizona. And I believe we're going to do the Q&A publishing with AZ Desert Swarm that you're doing. I think we're going to publish that on Saturday morning of the game, because it's a late game. It's a 6 p.m. kickoff against Arizona in Tucson, which, good night game in the desert. Good idea. Looking forward to the game, looking forward to our coverage, looking forward to what you and AZ Desert Swarm have to say. I think we should. The site is going to do a great job with this game that Oregon is definitely going to lose in the desert, because, you know, flipping Tucson, man, you know?
Yeah. We'll find out on Saturday morning what the consensus is from the Arizona side of things. Mm. Of course, I'll have their answers to my questions and a link to my answers to their questions on their site. So,
fun fact,
a little bit of reading on Saturday.
Oregon has not won in Tucson since 2011. Mm-hmm. Now, they've only played twice since 2011, but both of them were losses. Both of them were kind of screwy losses against, you know, teams that Oregon was better than. Why don't you do your due diligence, reader or listener, and read up these articles, because it should be good for you. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Thanks for joining me, Badwater. You got any parting words of wisdom?
No, just go Ducks, beat Arizona, get another bugaboo off our back.
All right, take care, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.